passé mes vies confiant, nous era ma guison. Não também ama sem medo e confiança. Não era mais visão. Olhar de nós criança, da torna brilha de inocência. E na mente esvitalhada, temporal talvez está mais nada.
Je t'aime, mi amore, me ni befie. E nele a la virilá, too much. Je t'aime, mi amore, me ni befie. E nele a la virilá, too much.
Listening to Mo Black, Salif Kiera, Benja, and Frank Fala with the tune Yamari. Before this, Losap Kansara with the tune Mother Soul. Thibaut Escalt with Animal Motif, Emotif before that. That's about it for me. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing in WRCT Pittsburgh. The best way to get in touch with me, visit my website, djfirefly.com.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Meet Ed, movie buff, animal lover, safe driver.
5 years of driving an ambulance teaches you a thing or two. If people knew what I know, lives could be saved. When I see a car trying to rush past a turning bus, I get concerned. You see, when big vehicles turn right, they have to swing wide to make the turn. And that's a lesson you don't want to learn the hard way. When trucks and buses turn, let's you and I wait.
It's our roads. It's our safety.
Visit www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
Welcome, everybody. We're going to start today with the president, Joe Biden, doing something that you will never, ever hear Donald Trump do. Actually, many things. Number one, express genuine love for his children. Okay, maybe that one's like sort of half joking, but very much seriously, expressing a total respect for the rule of law, due process, respecting juries and the process of the judiciary in the United States. Here is President Joe Biden yesterday speaking alongside Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, and Biden making it clear he's proud of Hunter Biden for overcoming addiction, despite the fact that Hunter got into trouble and has now been convicted, that he respects and will abide by the decision of the jury that he is indeed guilty, and that he will not be pardoning Hunter Biden, later saying he will not be commuting any potential sentence of Hunter Biden. Notice how different this is, and think about how differently convicted felon and civilly liable rapist Donald Trump would be handling this situation.
With regard to the question regarding the family, I'm extremely proud of my son, Hunter. He has overcome an addiction. He's one of the brightest, most decent men I know. And I am satisfied that I'm not going to do anything. I said I abide by the jury decision. And I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
Now, you will never get a moment like this from Donald Trump, even already with the suits and various problems, legal and civil, that his children are already having. He immediately jumps to it's weaponized and it's all rigged and it's all terrible and we're treated so unfairly and we're the biggest victims in the world, never mind the United States. The contrast could not be clearer. As this was wrapping up, Joe Biden was, you know, reporters like to yell questions, and the question was yelled, do you plan on commuting your son's sentence? Now, Hunter Biden hasn't even been sentenced yet. He may or may not get prison. Usually people don't for the crimes he was convicted of. But Joe Biden, again, stopping his handshake and greeting with Zelensky to say, no, I am not going to commute his sentence if he gets one, no matter what it is. Okay, so if you were listening, you might not have been able to see what went on there, but over the music, someone yelled about commuting the sentence, and Biden looked at the individual reporter and said no. Now, all of you who say, David, that's great, but it doesn't really impact the MAGAs because they already have conspiracy theories about this entire Hunter Biden conviction. And of course, you're absolutely right. If you have not been paying attention the last 24, 48 or so hours since the conviction of Hunter Biden, they've already come up with a number of conspiracy theories meant to push back against the obvious reality that Biden has not weaponized the justice system against his political opponents, because the justice system that he has appointed the attorney general to, Merrick Garland, is going after not only Democrats generally, but after his own family. A normal person would hear claims of victimhood from Trump about Biden's justice system and then consider, wait a second, that same justice system has prosecuted and now secured convictions against Biden's own son, Hunter Biden. It's going after Democratic Senator Bob Menendez. It's going after Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar. It is involved in and supportive of an ethics investigation into Democratic Congresswoman Cori Bush. Certainly seems to undercut the claim of Democratic weaponization. They now have come back and they've said, no, 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 you're not understanding. There's two versions of this conspiracy theory. Let me explain both. One is they went after Hunter for minor crimes to be able to say we did it and to completely excuse the major crimes, the big crimes, the Biden crime family stuff in which Joe Biden is allegedly involved. That's flavor number one of the conspiracy theory. The second flavor of the conspiracy theory is they have convicted Hunter Biden, but he's not going to get prison time. And that's the partisan biased proof that we are looking for. And of course, the reality is most people aren't even indicted for what Hunter Biden was indicted for, these gun charges. Putting that aside for a second, they almost never result in jail time. So if indeed Hunter doesn't get jail time, which would be completely expected, normal and typical, they will say that's the crime in terms of the carrying out of justice. And so you won't be able to satisfy them. But for those who like to think critically and sort of think through these things, what you just heard Joe Biden say, the humility, the respect for the rule of law, the respect for juries and due process. You will never hear that with Donald Trump. A confused Donald Trump ended a press conference after meeting with Republicans on Capitol Hill yesterday as the presumptive Republican presidential nominee without taking a single question after this totally cultish meeting that he had. You know, yesterday I told you Mitch McConnell is one of the senators going to this big meeting with Trump to welcome him as the presumptive nominee for their party. And despite all of the criticisms of Mitch McConnell over the many years about Trump's involvement in inciting a riot and everything else that went on, Mitch McConnell was going to kiss the ring. And boy, did they kiss the ring. Here's a little bit of video of Trump standing there getting a standing ovation from everybody. Yeah. And there's Tim Scott and creepy looking James Lankford. And you can see all the usual suspects here. Mitch McConnell, at the end of the day, when the rubber meets the road, desperate, desperate to retain access to power and party insiders. Here is an image of Mitch McConnell shaking hands with Trump, with Tim Scott next to him cheering on the entire thing. And then Trump spoke. He issued some statements with Republicans humiliatingly standing behind him, kicking things off with an impenetrable word salad. And it only got worse from here. Remember, this was a press conference at which Trump took zero questions. Here is Trump tossing quite the word salad.
But we have to get elected. We have to take this beautiful place and we have to make it really something very special again. Right now, it's not special. Right now, it's being scorned and being used as an example of when they look at the crime on the streets, when they look at all of the problems that we have, they're using us as a bad example of democracy. And they're getting away with murder, and we're not going to let it happen. So I just want to thank you for coming, and I want to thank everybody here. You're all either elected or you're going to be elected again and reelected. And
there you go. So Trump making nice with everybody and making it clear that it's a big love fest. Trump saying he's with the Republicans 1000% and the Republicans are with him 1000%. And here's the really important distinction I think is important to draw here. They are talking about unity. But there's a difference between actually being united and a sort of prisoner's dilemma of forced loyalty to avoid complete and total guaranteed self-destruction, which is what they're facing if they don't at least put a pretty face on all this. Trump here asserts unity, but it is really a forced veneer of loyalty. Is the way that I would say.
This is an outstanding group of people. I'm with them 1000%. They're with me 1000%. We agree just about on everything. And if there isn't, we work it out. And I've had a really great relationship with just about everybody here, with everybody here, just about all of the senators. And if it wasn't fantastic, it gets worked out. And we have one thing in mind, and that's making our country great. So thank you all very much. We appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
There you go. And that is Trump feebly, an enfeebled Trump, ending his, quote, press conference after under 5 minutes and refusing to answer a single question. And remember, one of the big stories, one of the big smocking guns, as Trump likes to write about Joe Biden, is supposedly that he doesn't do press conferences. And he doesn't take questions and he doesn't speak for a long time. He delivered a 100-minute State of the Union. He does press conferences. He deals with the pathetic and childish questions hurled up at him by reporters like Peter Ducey. But it is actually Trump who is doing that very thing. Now, after the fact, you know, the usual suspects were interviewed about the meeting. And I'll just play one example. They're all so pathetic. I'm just going to give you one example. Here is Senator J.D. Vance, a Republican from Ohio, who said that everybody loves Trump. No one blames Trump for the riots of January 6th. It's all just hunky dory kumbaya.
Republicans are being responsible for January 6th.
Well, look, I think that no real Republican with any credibility in the party is still blaming him for January 6th. Even, frankly, some of his critics were in the room and were supportive and are supportive. So it's a good thing. And I think the Republican Party is in a good place.
You've been one of his strongest critics.
So, of course, it's very much not true that no Republicans blame Trump for January 6th. But the way that they get out of this little problem is by the insertion of that word real Republican. The word real is doing some seriously heavy lifting there. It's the no true Scotsman fallacy. No real Republican would blame Trump for what happened on January 6th. Therefore, Mitt Romney and Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney and every single Republican that does blame Trump for what happened on January 6th definitionally must not be a real Republican. That's the way they get around this. And of course, J.D. Vance is doing double duty here. Not only is he discharging his duty as a member of the Republicans seeking to welcome Trump back into their club because he's the presumptive nominee, J.D. Vance is also, according to numerous reports, being vetted himself as Trump's possible VP. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later, because it is quite funny some of the questions he's been asked in this vetting process. You know, sometimes the crimes start to stack up. We've talked before about how sometimes when people enter the criminal justice system, it can be hard to get out because the crimes roll into other crimes. In a sort of funny way, but also a serious way, Donald Trump is now embroiled in more criminality. Listen to this. Donald Trump has admitted that he still has a gun in Florida, despite felony convictions that make him ineligible to own a gun. Wait a second. That doesn't sound right. More violations of the law from the guy who says he is the ultimate representation of law, order, and respect for due process. Salon reports Donald Trump admits he still has a gun despite felony convictions. And it reads, Trump, recently convicted of 34 felony charges, admitted to New York officials he had not surrendered a gun he possesses in Florida, but was registered in New York. It is a federal crime for someone convicted of a felony to possess a firearm or ammunition. Apparently, the deal with this is Trump used to have three pistols. Two of them were handed over to police in March of 2023 when Trump's gun license became suspended because of being arrested by the Manhattan DA. But there is a third gun, which he moved to Florida, and he has it there. And this is, of course, a major problem. Palm Beach police were asked about this. They told CNN, we didn't know anything about this gun, and it certainly wasn't turned over to us since May. Now, based on what's been going on with Hunter Biden, apparently, we take gun crimes seriously now, based on the fact that Hunter was prosecuted, indicted, and ultimately convicted of something for which most people are not ever indicted. We're talking here with Trump about 18 USC subsections 922 through 924. Felons and prohibited persons with firearms are subject to a maximum penalty of 15 years in prison for violation of said law. It actually is even worse than this. It is arguably a breach of Trump's bail conditions to have a firearm, which, again, if we didn't have a two-tier justice system, if we treated everybody the same way, Trump violating the conditions of his bail should put him immediately in jail pending sentencing on July 11th and give the guy credit for time served. Of course, it's not going to happen. You may recall that a condition of Donald Trump's bail is that he not break any other laws while he is out pending sentencing. And if Trump were treated fairly, he would be locked up. None of this will happen, would be my bet, because we do have a two-tier justice system. It's not Democrats and Republicans, the way Donald Trump likes to say. It is, of course, wealthy elites, which includes former presidents and kind of everybody else. But the criminality is not stopping. Let's talk a little bit about Bitcoin. This is not going to be the segment maybe you anticipate. Donald Trump is now saying on Truth Social that he wants all Bitcoin to be made in the USA.
Truth Central.
This is so painfully stupid, but this is a reflexive attempt from Trump to try to push back against what he perceives to be anti-cryptocurrency sentiment from Democrats. Trump posting to Truth Central, quote, vote for Trump. Bitcoin mining may be our last line of defense against a CBDC. Biden's hatred of Bitcoin only helps China, Russia, and the radical communist left. We want all the remaining Bitcoin to be made in the USA. It will help us be energy dominant. Now, even if we steel man and give Trump the absolute benefit of the doubt, I guess what he is saying is he wants Bitcoin mined in the United States. How this helps energy independence, I really couldn't tell you, because mining Bitcoin requires energy and a lot of it. It doesn't produce energy. So I, quite frankly, even if I try to be as charitable as possible, I don't understand how mining Bitcoin in the United States could make us energy independent. Putting aside for a second that Trump wants to make Bitcoin in the United States. Bitcoin is inherently decentralized. It's not controlled by any single entity or country. Some people like that, some people don't, but it is what it is. It operates on this global network of computers or nodes. They verify transactions. They secure the blockchain. The idea that we would make Bitcoin in a specific country kind of violates the very principles on which decentralization and global participation in the Bitcoin network were designed and is based. It's very strange. And when Trump suggests we should make Bitcoin in the United States, what it's communicating is the same thing Trump communicates on most issues, which he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand the process. I think it's maybe worth mentioning from an environmental perspective, many progressives are concerned about the carbon footprint of Bitcoin mining because of its high energy consumption. So what might actually underlie this is Donald Trump's nearly pathological fixation with just being against everything that he perceives progressives or Democrats or leftists to be for, and calling everything that the left is for socialistic or communistic. So my guess is that this is yet another one of those issues that Trump doesn't really understand, but knows that he wants to oppose Democrats or what he perceives the left to want at any case. And it ends up with him saying painfully stupid things like, let's make all Bitcoin made in the USA. Painfully stupid. But that's sort of the theme of this 2024 campaign. We have a tremendous program for you today. We're going to take the quickest of quick breaks, hear from a sponsor or two, unless you're a member, and then you get the commercial-free version of the show. And then we will be back with much, much more. I have an example for you today of a Republican brutally being fact-checked on live television and having no other option other than to admit, hey, you know what I just said was a lie. So he simply keeps on telling the same lie. This relates very much to something that takes up an entire chapter in my forthcoming book, which I'll tell you about in a moment. This is Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany. He was on CNN. He was trying to tell CNN anchor Boris Sanchez that they have the evidence of the illegal money, something with Joe Biden. Boris Sanchez fact checks him and says, not only is what you're saying not true, it didn't even happen when Joe Biden was vice president. Listen very carefully to what Tom Tiffany says, because this, if you blink, you will miss it. But this is one of the biggest problems with American political discourse right now. See if you can spot it, and then we will talk about it.
And there's no evidence in any of the documents put out by the Oversight Committee that a single dollar went to President Biden when he was in office. Therefore, there's no evidence that he did anything illegal, that he abused his power, or that he abused his power in office to help his family members or friends get wealthy.
Yeah, well, Joe Biden has a check in the amount of $40,000 that was has his name on it. You got another $200,000 check that came from Jim and Sarah Biden to him. I mean,
sir,
there's
sir,
over $20
million. Here. I actually have that check here. That was a check from 2018 when he was not vice president. And it actually says that this was a reimbursal. This was a loan repayment from his brother.
So you can make the case that the Bidens did not do this while Joe Biden was vice president, but I think it's contrary to the record. And it's contrary to what happened when Joe Biden was vice president and he went and called off the prosecutor.
All right. So now he goes over to the Victor Shokin thing, but that's not what I care about. Did you notice the language that Tom Tiffany used there? Tom Tiffany referred very specifically to a particular check. And then they put up the checks and they said, we've got these checks. These checks are not from when Joe Biden was president of, or vice president of the United States. And Tom Tiffany goes, well, you can make the case that he was not vice president at that time. That is not a matter of opinion. In March 2018, Trump was president. Biden was neither VP nor president. That language that you just heard is at the center of one of the biggest disasters in American political discourse. And when both sides deserve blame, I blame both sides. On this issue, it is almost exclusively the purview of the American right wing to introduce a matter of opinion language when things are just facts. I have an entire chapter in my forthcoming book called What Are Facts? And in the chapter, I explain sometimes the question is, what are the facts? Okay. When we have a disagreement as to how much of the budget went to, I don't know, funding food stamps, we have a question of what are the facts about that? We just have to find the number. What percentage of the federal budget went to food stamps? But we have a different problem in American political discourse right now, which is one side increasingly thinks that stuff that is just a matter of fact is actually a matter of opinion. When it comes to, I don't know, did the vaccine cause 17 million deaths, which of course it did not, the COVID vaccine. There are people who say when they are presented with all of the data telling us the vaccine has not caused 17 million deaths, they go, well, listen, I believe that it has. I have a different perspective, as if that is just as valid. And what you might hear deep in there is the same sort of my truth stuff that the right criticizes of the left as being this postmodern diversion from reality. People like Jordan Peterson and others criticize the left by saying, you know, you've got these leftists who just believe anything that they want to be true could be true. They often apply it to trans issues or whatever else. When these right wingers introduce language about opinion, when we're talking about factual matters, who was president March 2018? It wasn't Biden. Who was vice president 2018? It wasn't Biden. This is a complete derailment from even the mere possibility of moving forward on any issue when we can't even agree as to what counts as a fact. Pew Research did a very interesting study a few years ago. They took participants and they gave participants 10 statements. Five of the statements were opinions, things like ice cream is the best type of food or something like that. Five of the 10 statements were facts. And they said to the survey participants, categorize these, put the five facts, they didn't tell them it's five and five, put the facts under fact category and put the opinions under opinion category. And only 26% of respondents correctly categorized all five factual statements as facts. And only 35% of respondents correctly categorized the five opinion statements as opinions. These are disturbing numbers because we had enough trouble when we were just disagreeing about what the facts were. Now, close to, I mean, listen, more than half the country, based on the Pew Research study, doesn't even know what sorts of statements are statements of facts versus statements of opinion. One, let's leave it there for now. When it comes to this Joe Biden stuff, fortunately, it's going nowhere. But a really disturbing thing to see from these folks where it's like, if I just don't like the truth, I just claim it's a matter of opinion. I want to play for you a very sick fantasy that Alex Jones, conspiracy theorist of InfoWars, put forward about what he would like to see happen to Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, fortunately, I don't think Alex Jones would be in a position of power if Trump were to become president of the United States again. But here's the rub and here's the critical point. Many of the people who would be in Trump's cabinet and would be Trump staffers share the view that Alex Jones presents here. Take a listen to this.
We know this is a problem. It needs to be dealt with. The criminal gang leaders, the big heads of the central banks, Pfizer head, Fauci, all of them that lied to Trump, we know, created the disinfo, already had the vaccine ready years before they released the virus. They all need to go to prison for the rest of their lives. Well, it sounds sexy to say they need to be executed. But, you know, they sent Napoleon to an island twice because he had a lot of stay-behind networks, which was to keep fighting if they turn him into a martyr. You don't turn him into martyrs. You don't execute him. You just put him in a prison in solitary confinement. They can be out 1 hour a day, but you lock them up for the rest of their lives. Now, that said, it is constitutional if it can be shown that they knowingly, like Bayer Pharmaceutical did, put HIV and hepatitis and killed over a million hemophiliacs in the U.S. and Europe and Australia and other areas. It is the right thing to do that they be executed. But I'm saying that's up to juries.
The idea here is that at minimum, Dr. Anthony Fauci, an 83-year-old doctor who has spent five decades, the parts of six decades maybe, in public health, should be at minimum locked up for life, or he deserves to be executed, but a jury would have to agree to that. Now, as I said, I don't believe Alex Jones, as deranged as Trump is, I don't think Alex Jones is going to be in a position of power if Donald Trump becomes president. But the people who would be in charge have the same fantasy about imprisoning Dr. Fauci. During a congressional hearing just last week, repugnant, reactionary, retrograde Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene said to Dr. Fauci, "You should be in prison." So while it sounds absurd and hyperbolic and borderline impossible, maybe hearing it from Alex Jones, imprisoning Fauci, what are you talking about? This is indirectly on the ballot in November. Now, I'm going to be voting against it, to be clear. And it's really important that everybody understand we're not shaming anybody here. OK, but it's really important that people understand. If you take any step which enables Trump to get closer to the presidency, you are involved in helping this become a reality. This is not, you know, we hear about we shouldn't shame voters. Absolutely. We shouldn't shame anybody, but we need to have real conversations. And so this is why when people call in and they say to me, you know, David, I'm thinking of staying home. I don't like Trump, but I'm thinking of staying home to show my displeasure. Or I don't like Trump, but I'm thinking of writing in or voting third party for Cornel West or Jill Stein, or I don't know if Marianne Williamson's still running, or Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And that's why I say to them, absolutely, you can do that. No question about it. I understand what you're getting at. However, are you comfortable helping Trump enter the Oval Office again, where he will get two Supreme Court picks when Alito and Clarence Thomas say this is a good time to retire because Trump will replace us? And then Trump is responsible for 5/9 of the Supreme Court. And we have a MAGA Supreme Court until at least 2044, probably 2048, realistically 2050, or even a few years beyond that. And then you look back and you go, I had a role in that. You know why? Because I stayed home. I stayed home, or I wrote someone in. I can't do that. Now, you can look at me with a straight face and you can say, David, I don't care. I'm comfortable doing that. I'm comfortable taking actions that help Trump and people who have the same sick fantasies as Alex Jones enter power. If you're comfortable with that, by all means, do it. My argument is I'm not comfortable with it. So I'll be voting in a different way in November. Disgusting fantasy. I don't think Alex Jones will get to implement it, but there are people around Trump who have much the same fantasy, and I don't want them anywhere near any kind of center of power. I've spoken about Eric Hovde before. He is running for Senate in Wisconsin. He seems to have essentially no connection to Wisconsin. He lives in California. None of it makes any sense. He has now been caught using his own senior employees in a campaign ad meant to look like just average voters saying, you know, I think Eric Hovde is the guy that I should be voting for. This was not disclosed. It's pathetic. It's disgusting. It's more of the same of what we would expect. Check this out. WisconsinDems.org has the story. Eric Hovde caught using company senior executives in a campaign ad highlighting working Wisconsinites. So we're going to look at the video here. There's a couple of elements to this that are pretty sick. One is these are his employees. So even if you believe that these are hardworking average Wisconsinites, these are not exactly your average run-of-the-mill working Wisconsinites. These are senior executives for super rich dude Eric Hovde. The idea that they would say what they really feel if they are in a campaign ad for their boss also is just ridiculous. So take a look at this ad. It's only 29 seconds, and we're supposed to believe these are just middle-class workers with no connection to Eric Hovde other than believing that he's the best choice for Wisconsin.
These progressive lefties are really messing up our country with all their crazy ideas.
Yeah, open borders, giving illegals cash.
How about defunding the police and going soft on criminals?
Or letting boys play in girls' sports?
Look at all their crazy spending. They're bankrupting our country, driving up the costs of everything, including our beer.
Yeah, Baldwin, Biden, these wackadoodles need to go. I would even wish them a Wisconsin goodbye.
I'm Eric Hovde. I definitely approve these guys' message.
All right. So you get the point. By the way, it's he mentions that one of the voters mentions in the ad defunding the police. Police hasn't been defunded. I mean, Democrats don't want to defund the police. The police hasn't been defunded. Crime is down. And yet it doesn't even really matter. Nothing in here really matters other than can they weaponize against Democrats in any opportunity that they have. And so there's further coverage of this from Wisconsin Democrats. It talks about exposing these individuals. It identifies them specifically. They even found pages. So here we have a screenshot from the ad. And then they found their, you know, about us pages from their employer's website. And so there's like three different levels to this. There's probably five or six. One is, if you are Eric Hovde, do you see senior executives in cushy positions as the average Wisconsinite? That's one relevant question. Number two, there's the dishonesty of the ad and the fact that these are his employees. Number three, there's the fact that the criticisms they outline in the ad about Tammy Baldwin and about Biden aren't true. You know, the whole defund the police thing is of particular interest to me because we've been covering crime really closely and we've been covering police reform really closely. And I've outlined a 10-point police reform plan that doesn't involve defunding, at least as a principle. Maybe there is a police department that's overfunded, but in many cases, it's we want to reallocate funds so the police department is more effective and better serving the needs of the community. But without getting into that, the police have not been defunded, and it's certainly not something that we've seen at the federal level from Joe Biden. And if police were, they should hope police haven't been defunded, because if we had defunded the police and crime continued to decline as significantly as it had, it would speak really poorly to their argument that in order to reduce crime, you need to increase funding for police. But again, remember, the police haven't been defunded. So Eric Hovde, just ringers. That's all it is. People that work for him. Put in there to look like they are your average Wisconsin voter. Let's hope people don't fall for it. Wisconsin really could be a deciding state in November. So it's one we need to watch very, very closely. Don't vote for Eric Hovde. He's absolutely horrible. And he doesn't even live in Wisconsin. This is so funny. J.D. Vance, the Republican senator, appeared on Fox News the other day. And we now know that J.D. Vance is part of a group of potential Trump vice presidential running mates who's being vetted. This is so damn funny. He says one of the ways in which he's being vetted is whether he's committed crimes, which is so funny because Trump's a convicted felon. Who is Trump to ask whether anybody else has committed crimes? If anything, if Trump really believes that it's an advantage, maybe what he means is, have you committed a crime? No. Would you be willing to in order to join my campaign? Listen to this.
You've heard that some of them have been asked to submit documents to be vetted. you're not at that level yet.
Well, so look,
they've
asked us for a number of things. I think that a number of people have been asked to submit this and that.
Like your taxes or something?
I don't know everything
your criminal
they've
background?
Been asked. But, yeah, I mean, certainly, like, you know, have you committed a crime? Have you ever lied about this? Certainly you've had those conversations, but I think a lot of people were having those conversations. Like-
now, Steve Doocy is actually making a really good point with his little snickers there. Have you been asked to provide your tax returns? Which Trump has not provided, dating all the way back to 2015, which every other presidential candidate has provided. Steve Doocy is pointing out J.D. Vance is being asked to provide stuff that even Trump hasn't provided to the American people. What about your criminal record? Trump has a criminal record. He was just convicted on 34 felonies. And there's actually sort of a broader question here. Does this vetting even make a difference anymore? Or better said, to whom does the vetting make a difference? Is it to the American people? Because the American people voted for a guy in Trump. They voted for him in 2016. Many of them voted for him in 2020, and many are going to vote in 2024. Tens of millions of people have and will vote for a guy who is a convicted felon, who has cheated and sexually assaulted and all these different things, has not provided his tax returns. So who is it that these vetting mechanisms are supposed to be protective for? Is it the people or is it what Trump wants? And then obviously the double standard, the hypocrisy with Trump as convicted felon asking others, tell me about the crimes you may or may not have committed is all very, very funny. Zooming out a little bit as far as VP, I'm curious to hear from you. I don't see anyone who's being considered here, J.D. Vance, you know, Doug Burgum, depending on which list you look at, there's different opinions as to sort of like who's being seriously considered versus only casually and this sort of thing. I don't see anyone that brings any level of excitement or in any serious way helps to expand Donald Trump's electorate. It's tough for me to think that, let me put it a different way. It's not that there aren't people whose politics align more with J.D. Vance than they do with Trump. There are certainly people out there who, if you said Vance or Trump, who do you align with more? They would say, oh, I align more with J.D. Vance. The question is, are there undecided voters in critical swing states that are likely to switch to Trump if he picks someone as uninspiring as J.D. Vance or as Doug Burgum? Or honestly, at this point, I don't even know who else is being considered. It's tough to think of any of these supposed final candidates really moving the needle in any serious way. Let me know what you think. And maybe more importantly, if you have an idea for who would actually move the needle and help Donald Trump in a significant way in the states that are likely to be the decision makers, let me know who that would be. I wasn't going to talk about this, but this was pointed out by some of our viewers. It is absolutely the case that Piers Morgan and his producers doctored my appearance on his program last week. I'm going to give you some of the background on this, and we are going to look at a clip in a moment. But to sort of put it all out front, when I appeared on the Piers Morgan program, I was not given any release to sign where I acknowledged that my statements may be edited or doctored or truncated. I was not told by anyone there that they may chop or modify what I said. And they did that. OK, and I wasn't even going to bring it up. I didn't realize how obvious it was. Other people found it. Here is just one example. And you will notice that there is a very abrupt cut. And indeed, they cut stuff out that I said. Now, I'll tell you what it was that I said in a moment. I think the visual is important. But you might be able to tell that it was cut just from the audio. Let's take a listen.
We can discuss that part later, but I think Trump's going to lose either way.
It was right there. Okay? It was right there. I'm going to go back again a few extra seconds and see if you can catch it.
Currently is spewing out from every Democrat poll might be tempered by a pretty hard reality shock if it plays out the way Alan suggests.
Well, I agree with much of what Alan is saying and not all of it. He's a lawyer. I am not. And to some degree, I don't even know why I'm here, but we can discuss that part later. But I think Trump's going to lose.
OK, so they cut out an entire exchange there. And I should have recorded it on my end. I'm trying to remember sort of how it went. I was jokingly at that point. It kind of makes me sound like a prick when I say I don't even know why I'm here. I was sort of just joking around, like, you brought a lawyer on and now you're having me react to what a lawyer said and I'm not a lawyer. And it's like, who am I to even react? I said more about not being a lawyer and this is just, you know, my political whatever. And then Piers said, oh, well, let me tell you why you're here, David. You're here because you are a very compelling speaker with an audience. Or, you know, he kind of praised me in some way and we joked. And then I went back to this conversation. Does it dramatically change the understanding of the substance? No, it doesn't. Was there a cut there that definitely changes one's impression of me if you don't know me and this is the first you're seeing? Yeah, I think the way they cut it makes me seem like a little bit of a prick. And maybe most importantly, did they tell me that they were going to make cuts and there were cuts made, some cuts made later as well, I think, although I really should have recorded it on my own. Yeah, they should have told me. And, you know, we tell guests, even though these are not being recorded live, it is as if it were live, unless like you get disconnected in the middle of the interview. If you swear, we'll bleep it because we're on radio. But other than that, it is a live to tape interview. We are not going to edit this. And if we thought we might need to or had a plan to, I'm trying to think if there have been instances. There really haven't, but we would tell a guest if we were going to do that. So listen, make of it what you will. I think generically, it was interesting to be on with Piers Morgan, how much it did to move ahead the conversation on any major issues. I kind of am less sure, but there were cuts made to the things I said. I was not notified in advance, and people can judge for themselves whether there is any problem with doing that. We certainly tell our guests if it's something we plan to do. All right, it is time for Friday feedback. You can always email info@davidpakman.com if you have a message that you may want included, but we'll also pick YouTube comments, Twitter replies, TikTok comments. Who knows what will show up here? A lot of confusion in this week's Friday feedback, I will mention. Ernie Forrest said on YouTube, "Were you always a McCain supporter, Pakman? Or did you start defending him only after Trump voiced his own opinion of him?" You know, everything is so black and white in American politics these days, and especially with some of these MAGA types. I think what this person is referring to is that I said John McCain exhibited a form of toughness that is totally alien to Trump. McCain went and fought, and in the Vietnam War was held as a POW and was tortured, and then he came back, and then he had a successful and productive career. And even if I didn't agree with his politics, it's still a story that gives you a completely different understanding of a man than it does of Trump growing up with a silver spoon in his mouth in Queens and Manhattan, and then getting a doctor's note about his ankles to not have to be drafted. Okay. It's not that I'm a McCain supporter, and in 2008, I voted for his opponent, Barack Obama. But Ernie, you know, I think you've got this brain rot here where everything's black and white. Everything's one thing or the other. And this is how we ended up in this problem politically that we have in this country to a great degree. M. Teeters says, "I'll vote for the guy that had a great economy instead of this burning trash heap we have now. Thanks for asking." Please get in touch with me so I can hear more specifically from you. Which economic metrics are telling you that we have a burning trash heap right now? I've tried to confront some of these people on Twitter, and I will say to them, got it. You claim the economy was great under Trump and now it's bad. I understand the argument you're making. Tell me, what day when Biden became president, on which day of his presidency, did the economic markers you pay attention to signal the economy had become a disaster? Was it on the day Biden became president? Was it a month in? Was it a year in? And then tell me, what is it? Oh, well, it's the unemployment rate in the stock market, to which then we could go and look and we'd say, oh, look, the unemployment rate is lower. The stock market's higher. So it couldn't be that. And as you all know, if you actually examine these sorts of claims to any degree, they fall apart very, very quickly. So for M. Teeters, who says he's going to vote for the great economy guy Trump rather than the burning trash heap economy Biden, give us the actual information. Tell me which metrics and on what date you realize the metrics now say we have a terrible economy. A Reddit user, Magic Must Be Me, posted a thread where he wrote, "Does anyone suspect the White House meeting that David and other creators attended is connected to lack of Gaza coverage?" You know, you don't have to dig deep for some secret conspiracy or explanation about what's going on the show. We covered Ukraine, Russia at the beginning. And since this is not a foreign policy show, it essentially doesn't come up anymore, except in some context of, oh, there was a meeting between Trump and this official or NATO. And similarly, we covered what's going on in Israel, Gaza at the beginning. It's now been more than 6 months. I guess it's been almost 8 months. And this is not a foreign policy show. And it's not a big topic on the show. The idea that I went to a meeting and then I came back and no longer talked about Gaza is just ridiculous. And by the way, you can also just look on the YouTube channel. That meeting I was invited to was at the State of the Union. So I think that's the first week in March. That was already 5 months in. And what you will see is that the average weekly coverage of what's going on in Israel, Gaza, or Ukraine, Russia did not change after that meeting. Went on to say, would make sense. The more liberal voices speaking against Biden hurt his reelection. The meeting was totally off the record, so nothing of substance can be shared. I'm fairly convinced there is some amount of leverage here, fueling David's nonstop coverage of drivel about Trump and Kristi Noem and lack of coverage of our domestic participation of the genocide in Gaza. Yeah, I mean, this is just so silly. And the other thing you have to understand is, even first of all, bringing 10 mid-level creators to the White House and saying, please don't talk about Gaza, it's bad for us. As absurd as that would be, because it's just 10 small creators and it would do nothing to change the bigger media dynamic, even if the White House were willing or thought it was a good idea to do that, it would leak that they did that, and that would become an insanely huge story. When something is off the record, all that means is they don't want you sharing quotes. That's it. But I've already said, I asked a question to the vice president. In fact, if anything, my question was adversarial. I asked the vice president about what is their plan for counteracting the fact that there is a slice of Democrats that are upset with them about Israel, Gaza. So, no, it's a beautiful conspiracy theory. It is not based in fact. All right. Seth wrote in, and Seth wrote in about the Royce White interview and says, tell me you think you're an alpha without telling me you're an alpha, right? Absolute fragile masculinity at its most delicate. From not having any valid points and arguing himself in circles to interrupting at every opportunity to repeat the same invalid nonsense, it was very difficult to listen to the interview. Identity politics aside, even if Royce was white, he is a pretty typical Republican, concerned with non-existent issues and submitting zero substantial policy ideas. Yeah, Seth's view of the Royce White interview was basically the most common feedback I got. Also, this from Sparky. David, please don't ever interview Roy again unless you set ground rules first that he must not interrupt every time you speak. That interview was worse than the first Trump-Biden debate from that perspective, and you seem to let him control it. Yeah, I mean, I think I should have muted him earlier when he kind of tried to keep going. I should have just muted him, and I would have still been able to hear him, but the audience would not, and maybe it would have been less disruptive and disorienting. But listen, I think it's interesting to talk to those guys because of the such obvious lack of substance. And I can't imagine he has any shot at defeating Amy Klobuchar. HTNN commented on YouTube, maybe when old Davey Packman figures out what a woman is, we can have a discussion about what facts and reality are. You know, the what is a woman people, I haven't heard from them much lately, but they're still out there. And it's really not the gotcha that they think it is. You know, the answer to what is a woman is different in an obstetrics and gynecology setting than it is in a gender discrimination setting, or than it is in a social setting, or a, they think that there's this gotcha where unless you give the one definition that applies everywhere, at an OBGYN's office, woman is someone that was born biologically female. If you are, again, if you're a trans woman and you go to an OBGYN and say, I've missed my period, I think I'm pregnant, it's very quickly going to be dealt with as a mental health issue. But that's a very different scenario than what about gender discrimination under the law for someone who exists in society and socially as a woman, based on all of the typical norms and signals that we use to figure out who am I talking to here. So, you know, it's very boring that they're still on this what is a woman thing. But some of them have run out of, they don't have anything else. I mean, they don't have anything else to talk about. So they go back to that. Girlshine says, I'm from the UK and we don't understand what's happened to the United States. A convicted rapist slash felon is running for president. What the F? This is mind blowing. This incredulity that you see on the screen in which I just read to you is what I'm trying to explain to the audience when I say, guys, this isn't normal. When I talk to friends and family in Europe, in South America, all over the world, when I hear from audience members in different parts of the world, it's not like, oh, who's better for the economy, Biden, Trump? It's, has the country lost its mind? This doesn't even pass the sniff test. Convicted rapist and civilly liable rapist, convicted felon, running for president, and he might win? What is wrong with your country? And you need only watch video from this weekend's Trump rally to figure out what's wrong. Flip to my Lou wrote, I gave Biden a chance, gave him 3.5 years to get his act together, and the guy has done nothing at all for the middle class. He's only made things worse. It's time to get Trump back in to fix this mess. Here's my question. Is this person reachable by fact, or are they too far gone? Because as you all maybe know, when you have sustained low unemployment under 4% for a longer period than we've seen in 50 years, that's good for the middle class. The very wealthy can afford to be out of a job. It's good for the middle class. When you cut costs on specific medications, or when you cut or rather forgive student loan debt, that helps the middle class. I don't know that there is any factual presentation that someone like Flip to my Lou would find convincing when it comes to the economy. And I know I started with this and I'll say it again. Tell me exactly the metrics that say to you, the economy is worse now than it was under Trump. And then we'll look at them together and we'll evaluate them. But they never send them to me, you know, they just never do. Make sure that you're signed up at joinpacman.com to get instant access to the bonus show and all of the other great membership perks. Remember that at davidpacman.com/book, you can get my original children's book, Think Like a Detective. You can get my second children's book, Think Like a Scientist. And you can get my third children's book out on an election year, Think Like a Voter. You can get all three of them, or one or two. Check them out at davidpacman.com/book. I will see you on the bonus show, and we'll be back Monday as well. Welcome, everybody. We start with what is considered a big deal in the election projection sort of industry today, which is that 538 has published its first 2024 election projection, Trump versus Biden. And the results, can we call them stunning? Can we call them shocking? Can we call them surprising? I don't know where that noise came from. No, we really can't call them any of those things. We can call them corroborating of exactly what I've been laying out to you for months now. The 538 projection, who is favored to win the 2024 presidential election? 53 times out of 100 in simulations, Biden wins. 53 out of 100. And in 47 out of 100 simulations, Donald Trump wins. What this means is that it is a toss-up. What this means is that exactly what I have been saying, those who are confidently declaring that Biden obviously will win are not basing their projection in reality. Those who are confidently projecting that it is Donald Trump who will win are not basing their projection in reality, and that this is likely to come down to a relatively small number of votes in a small number of states. Now, let's dig into the simulation a little bit more deeply. As you can see here, there is a sort of distribution curve, and I'll describe what we're looking at for people who are only listening. There's a distribution curve of possible outcomes, and as you can see, they are really grouped right around the middle. You could make the case that there are more scenarios in which Trump wins. This isn't really an accurate interpretation of this model. What the model does suggest is that some of Trump's paths to 270 electoral votes include a larger margin of victory than some of Biden's. And that's by the very nature of which states are definitely going to go Biden and Trump and sort of the realities of that. If you're interested in seeing the full list of polls that 538 uses in making these projections, you can do that. It's not super relevant to our discussion today. One of the interesting things is where how has the forecast changed over time? Now, what's interesting about this is that they only just now are issuing their full projection, but you can back out some of this data. And what you can see if you go back is that there was a period where it seemed as though Biden was likely to come away with more electoral votes than he is right now. But the scenario that in this 53 to 47 margin, 538 says is the most likely right now is Biden 275 and Trump 263. Remember, 270 is the line between winning and losing. And so that is a very, very, very small margin, significantly smaller than it was in 2020. So if you're trying to figure out how important is it that I vote generically, obviously, the truth is because of the Electoral College, if you vote in California, it's less important that you vote than it is if you vote in North Carolina or even more Wisconsin or even more Arizona. We've talked about that, and that's part of why I'm against the Electoral College, but it is the system we have, and that's the one that we will be fighting this election over. But importantly, expecting a tighter electoral margin than in 2020. In terms of what are the critical toss-up states, they are, as I've been saying, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia. It is those five. And with those five, potentially hangs in the balance who will be the next president of the United States. What are the closest races? The closest ones, according to this model, are Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. All of those are under a 2-point margin. And then you get to larger margins. And then you can look at a whole bunch of other scenarios here. What's the takeaway here? There is one and only one takeaway, which is to pat me on the back and to say, you know what, David, you're right. This is probably going to be close. And I'm, of course, kidding. There's nothing particularly stunning or difficult about my prediction, which is elections in the United States, given the hyperpolarized nature of the country. Given that if you put an R or a D in front of a candidate's name, that gets you the lion's share of your potential vote. And then the rest is just sort of like, who can you convince from this much smaller group that might go one way and might go the other way? In addition to this, we have the reality that because we have no national popular vote contest, these are 50 individual popular vote contests, which then inform the Electoral College. A large swath of the country kind of doesn't matter because the partisan demographics are so skewed one way or the other. Although someday Texas may be close and may be in play for Democrats, we would love it to be. It's not in play this year. California is not in play this year. It's going to go to Democrats, period. So we end up with a scenario where really this is an election that will be decided by those voters in five or so states who are considering, I might vote, I might stay home. I might vote for Biden, or I might vote for Trump, or I might vote third party or write somebody else in. So a country of 340 million, you obviously reduce that to the number of eligible voters. You then reduce that to the 60 or so percent that we expect to vote. And then you reduce this to the swing voters in the five key states. How many voters does this election depend on?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Eid is today, but the warplanes haven't stopped all night. What Eid? In all the Arab countries, people are celebrating Eid and enjoying it in their countries, and they're having a good time. But what about us? Where is our Eid? At war? In destruction?
The Israeli military announces a daytime tactical pause in its attacks on Rafah to allow humanitarian aid to enter the Strip after systematically blocking aid from reaching Palestinians in Gaza for 8 months. But UNRWA says that nothing has changed. We'll go to Rafah for an update from UNICEF spokesperson James Elder. Then former President Trump hits the campaign trail after visiting top Republicans at the Capitol for the first time since January 6th.
First day in office, we're going to close up the border. First day in office, we're going to drill, baby, drill.
We'll get response from Democratic Congress member Jamie Raskin, who served on the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack and calls Trump's meetings with Republican leaders a scandal and a disgrace. And acclaimed author Arundhati Roy could soon face trial under India's contested anti-terror laws after Prime Minister Narendra Modi's far-right ruling BJP party gave the go-ahead for her prosecution.
India's constitution has effectively been set aside. The Indian Penal Code is being rewritten. If the current regime wins a majority in 2024, it is very likely we will see a new constitution.
The charges against Arundhati Roy stem from comments she made about Kashmir in 2010, but supporters say this is an attack on free speech. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations warning more than 50,000 Palestinian children in Gaza require immediate medical treatment for acute malnutrition. In a statement, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said the situation in Gaza is catastrophic as residents continue to face desperate levels of hunger. Muslims across the world today are marking the holy day of Eid al-Adha, but it is a day of mourning in Gaza, where the death toll from Israel's war has topped 37,300.
How are we supposed to be happy on Eid while every day there are martyrs, wounded people every minute, every second? There are no houses. This area used to be the best area in Khan Yunis. Now it's all destruction and rubble. Now our biggest dream is to live in a house. There are no houses and no life. Life has been diminished.
A new investigation by the Associated Press has revealed at least 60 Palestinian families have lost 25 or more family members in Israel's ongoing war. In some cases, entire bloodlines of families have been killed. AP highlights the story of Yusuf Salem. 173 of his relatives were killed in Israeli airstrikes in December. About 100 more members of his family have died since then. Yusuf Salem told the AP, quote, "My uncles were wiped out totally, the heads of households, their wives, children and grandchildren," unquote. In more news from Gaza, aid shipments are no longer coming in by sea to Gaza. The U.S. military's temporarily removed the pier it just built due to rough seas at the cost of over $300 million, the building of that pier. This comes just over a week after the pier was reattached, after the first pier was damaged in a storm. Meanwhile, on Sunday, Israel announced it would pause attacks along an aid route in southern Gaza during daylight hours. But the head of UNRWA says operationally, nothing's changed in southern Gaza. Israel's announcement came a day after fighters from Hamas killed 8 Israeli soldiers in Rafah in an ambush. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dissolved Israel's war cabinet following the recent resignation of former military chief Benny Gantz. This comes as mass protests continue in Israel.